you if you clock in within 2 minutes, you win.
Oh. Can I get that in my contract, too?
Yeah. You're the mayor. You can set the contract.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the January 22nd meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll?
Fritz.
Here.
Fish. Saltzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Hales.
Here. Let's begin with, I don't believe we've had any requests to take things off the consent calendar yet, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let's take communications items first.
Item 59, request of Carrie White to address council regarding support Right to Dream 2.
Good morning, Mr. White. Come on up.
My name is Carrie White. According to the website Portland, Oregon Gov Police, the mission of the Portland Police Bureau is to reduce crime and fear of crime. We work with community members to preserve life, maintain human rights, protect property, and promote individual responsibilities and community commitment. As commendable as the mission statement sounds, it is not being carried out. As I speak in front of you, there are human beings here in the city having their human rights violated. The same Bureau claims to work to preserve life is working with Clean and Safe to take the very things people need to survive. I'm talking, of course, of the cruel and inhumane practice of moving Portland citizens without housing from place to place when they have nowhere to go. Often their belongings, including medications, sleeping bags, and other cold weather gear, which they need to live through the winter months, is thrown away. Although current policy states that it must be held for 30 days, if you don't recognize it when it is spelled out for you, I'll use the term you're more comfortable with, sweeps. When will this end? When will the people quit getting the very things they need for survival taken from them? When will the city of Portland wake up and realize they are essentially giving people the death sentence by taking their blankets, sleeping bags, and other cold weather gear? They're forcing them to face the elements without protection. There's not enough shelter space or affordable housing. Mayor Hill, as police commissioner, if you order sweeps in front of City Hall this last summer, you can stop the sweeps that are currently increasing now. Quit sweeping people from one place to another and find solutions. These are human beings, not garbage to be tossed aside, as the name implies. Thank you.
Thanks. If you have any information about situations where we haven't stored people's property properly,
yeah,
because that's what's
clean
required.
Clean and safe all the time.
Well, let us know in my office, because that is the law.
Gather up all their stuff, and they throw it away. We know one individual in particular that's had it done 4 times, and when he goes to Clean and Safe to get his stuff, they say, oh, we don't know where it is, or is your name on it? And if his name ain't on his stuff, they go, well, then we don't know what stuff is yours.
Okay, I'll check on that. Thank you. Thank you. Next one, please.
Item 60, a request of Tamara DeRitter to address council regarding comprehensive parking implementation program, communication with developers, and impact created by apartment development.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me the time to speak with you today. I've got an urgent matter that needs your immediate attention. As most of you know, mobility equals prosperity. Due to the changing demographics, increasing densities, a shortage of transportation funds, and an anemic transit system, Portland is facing increasing roadway gridlock. I support the Oregonian Editorial Board in their request for the City Council to convene several full-on conversations that go beyond pothole filling to people moving. In addition, cumulative development impacts are choking corridors for the lack of parking. We need PDOT to regularly schedule on-site traffic monitoring and develop proactive strategic parking systems in these corridors. Such systems need to be coupled with an active engagement of the businesses and residential communities. Strategic parking together with transit, bicycles, and other modes of travel can keep people moving. As you may remember, over a year ago, I spoke with you on behalf of the Apartment Parking Task Force. Our November 2012 survey of the issues at the time identified a need for action to deal with cumulative impacts of new development. An overarching concern by residents was regarding how they could retain mobility. Key issues identified include equitable distribution of parks to offset density, livability, creating proactive approach to address increasing parking needs, mobility, and a timely notification of neighborhoods and businesses for nearby construction activities such as demolitions and multifamily developments, health and livability. These issues were supported by over 70% of those respondents, over 700 residents. The fact that the city has not taken action in addressing these issues has contributed to a growing frustration with city staff and officials. These cumulative impacts continue to weigh on the community. But mobility is not just transit or just bicycles, nor is it just cars. It is a means by which workers can get to their jobs on time. It is a means by which products can be made and delivered on schedule. It is a core tenet by which cities grow and thrive, leading to economic vitality for community and funds to help maintain livability. An individual's mobility may include all these modes of travel or none of them in daily commute. Can I continue?
Yes, please. No.
Key elements in fostering mobility include a robust transit system, shared vehicle usage and strategic off-street parking, safe bicycle alternatives, and travel modes. But let's not stop there. It also includes access to high-speed internet, one-stop-shop website for mobility options, parking apps for smartphones that identify what parking is available, and tracking individual carbon use options, and much more. Troubling numbers are challenging us to all come to the table for this discussion. Because of aging baby boomers, the number of Portland residents over 65 years of age will be more than double to nearly 400,000 people within the next 20 years, many of whom wish to age in place, where 80% of these households own at least one vehicle. Because Portland's unique attraction of residents the age of 30 to 50, the number of over 55 will only continue to rise following the baby boomers for an additional 30 years. This is counter to the rest of the U.S. demographic, which decreases during that time. This brings forward the considerations
Tamara,
of changing.
Tamara, we have to get you to stop because you have used your time, but we have your statement, and it's very well done.
Okay.
And may give a council members a chance to respond a little bit, but I just really appreciate your good effort on this. There's some work underway already. Commissioner Novick has launched an effort to look at transportation funding options, which I'm assisting him with and which is already underway and involves some citizen input as well. But I bet we would like to hear more from you on those issues. And also, you're probably already plugged into this, but these issues of balancing mobility and livability and density are very much in play with our update of the comp plan, which will be completed this year. So,
which I'm very active.
Yeah. So on both fronts, I think both on the land use side and on the transportation priorities and funding side, you know, the wheels are turning and are going to produce something in the way of a specific proposal over the next 6 months. So I do want you to stay engaged because this really is a year in which a lot is going to be on the table on just these issues.
Yeah, I just want you to understand, and I gave you documentation about the development along Division Street. I mean, there's close to 400 additional parking spaces that have not been built.
Yeah.
And that is an opportunity for you with developers coming in to at least create a common parking site. And it's not happening, and you're
that's why
missing
we
up on the resource.
Keep tuning the code in the comp plan. So.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Steve, anything else you want to add?
Well, I mean, I just wanted to reiterate, I mean, one of the points that we discussed during the parking requirement discussions last year, which is that if we mandate more parking for more development, then that does have the effect of increasing the cost of housing. And, I mean, you talk about TriMet's ridership reducing. I mean, there's if we sort of decide we are going to do everything possible to make it easier for people to drive and assume that people are continuing to drive than we are building for the car and not building for transit.
Oh, totally. And to some I'm looking at we need to monetize parking. I'm not afraid of that. And having parking zones is an important thing to monetize the price of parking your car. But, you know, just not having a car doesn't fix it when transit is losing ground.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
fair
you.
Enough. Thanks very much, Tamara. Appreciate it.
Item 61, request of Joe Schaefer to address council regarding parking issues.
Good morning. Welcome.
I'll try not to stumble. My left contact seems to be taking a direct suicide leap out of my eye. So advanced apologies, okay? Okay. It's a little bit of a misnomer with the parking. It is parking issues, but it's also in regard to the micro-housing projects and no parking, and is it a good idea? As a community, many of us are concerned about what this will do to our neighborhoods. In Hollywood, there is a new development proposed on a 50 by 100-foot lot for a five-floor building, which is four above ground and one basement level, micro-apartments. We heard there would be 10 units in the building. We found out there would be 56 bedroom micro apartments ranging in size from 173 to 200 square feet. The 10 units means that there are shared kitchens, two per floor, and one laundry. The developer is coming in as a group home. The building will have no parking, no outside space for renters, no additional storage outside their bedroom, no common living room. There is some storage for bicycles, but not nearly enough for all 56 apartments. There is no space allotted for a janitor and or cleaning service, and no on-site manager. If the thought is that with no outdoor space, they will utilize one of our many city parks. Good luck with that, because Normandale is 15 blocks away and Grant Park is 10. Actually, how does the city define a unit? One would think that a unit would have a common door leading into a defined area outlined by walls that actually enclose each unit. This particular building has an imaginary line on each floor crossing a long hallway. The front half is one unit, and the back half is another unit on each floor. The demolition and construction for this project will also have a negative impact on the businesses adjacent to it. Mother and Child Education Center, Hollywood Community Acupuncture, and the law offices on the street depend on a calming and quiet atmosphere to serve their clients. When we met with the architect and asked about the intrusive nature of the build-out, we were told that they would only be on-site during the normal hours dictated by the city ordinances. In other words, Monday through Friday, 7 to 5, which, by the way, matches the hours of these businesses on the street. The architect gave the impression that he thought construction would be of a minor inconvenience to us. Really? We also felt that the developer had a general disregard for their new neighbors. The adjacent businesses are in single-family houses that are quite a bit lower and... Can I keep going?
You've got 30 seconds.
So okay.
Wrap up. We do have your statement. So
okay.
I would say rather than finishing your statement, why don't you just wrap up and tell us what you'd like us to really focus on here.
Okay. Is this really the way we want our neighborhoods to grow? No input from the neighborhood businesses, property owners, or tenants. It seems as though there is little or no regard for those who have worked hard to grow their businesses, live in, and enrich our community. Our fear is that developments like microhousing are, well, okay, I'm done.
Thanks very much. And again, thank you for putting this in writing. Again, we're working on the comp plan now, and we're also trying to adjust, and Commissioner Fritz may have some comments about this, to something new that our code maybe didn't fully anticipate.
Right.
Actually, there's no parking required, even if they were regular apartments in this place, because it's so close to light rail.
Right.
So the mayor is correct that if citizens want changes in how development happens in neighborhoods, the comprehensive plan is where to make those changes.
Right. And on the map that I included has an outline of why there's so many spots in this neighborhood that have no parking already.
Right. So that's something that needs
street parking. I mean, street parking, and then the Times parking, and it's just a lot of density for a lot of cars with no place to go.
And that was set when the Hollywood Plan District
was done,
so that is what needs to be changed.
Yeah.
But I do want to be clear with everybody that there's no parking required in any kind of multifamily there. The other point that I have been trying to change for the last 20 years, and I'd love your assistance on this, is to change the multifamily standards for things like common open space and places for people to play. So I hope that you'll participate in the comp plan process. There's a link to how to get there on the front page of my website.
I'm on the parks thing with you. I've been to the parks meeting with you.
Right.
For that,
yeah,
so.
Good. Thank you very much. Well done. Thanks. Appreciate this. Yeah, this is a difficult, this emergence of the new micro apartments phenomenon is one more case where, you know, a zoning code is a kind of a blunt instrument. You know, we try to regulate for what we want, and then somebody thinks of something, frankly, that we hadn't thought of.
Actually, this is what we want about.
Well, but I wasn't sure we ever thought of units this small.
It does. You know? But what's interesting is that 80% of the residents of similar projects in other cities don't own cars, which is very different from what we found on the apartments on Division
Larger
Street.
Larger units in those cases.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, in fact, the concern that Ms. Schaefer brought up about the bicycle parking may be more of an issue than the car parking in this particular type of development.
Good point.
The other point is that they have the company who's doing the one in Hollywood are being very careful to locate in places with shopping, with parks, although 10 blocks is quite a nice walk, and near very good transit. So I think it is a type of development that can work. It would be awful in the wrong place where people would be driving rather than using transit.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Okay, number 62.
Request of Mark J. Hoffhines, Jr. to address council regarding update on homelessness up to current date.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning. As you hopefully know, I handed these cards to you guys at each of your offices.
Yes, thank you.
Hopefully you guys get up online and check it out. The sweeps have been touched on up on. First, I want to update on the fact that no outreach workers still yet to date showed up out front to even offer any solution to them being taken care of. I don't know how many months it's been, I'm just close to getting 8 months at least. But they also touched up on the sweeps. I want to touch up on the sweeps, especially because they're happening again, especially during the winter months. It's ridiculous. You're talking about not knowing about this, Charlie Hales, where you're over the police bureau. You need to get on their case, because I got a 7 minutes and 17 second video of an officer doing nothing but throwing people's property away.
Okay, send that to us, please.
So, and even though I gave him the name of the person whose property was, he still refused to take the name and refused to give the property back. I would play it, but the language is a little inappropriate. All right. So, anyways, because as it says, the homeless, you're supposed to have 24-hour notice for them to actually be able to take them and out of that area. I'm looking at the ORS right now, and I don't know how the heck they think that they're just getting around this, deeming it as trash. Who the heck are they to deem it as trash? It's personal property. It's not trash. Piece of plastic on the sidewalk, that's trash. Someone's blankets, that's their livelihood. So, I guess as of today, there's at least 5 people have died. And that's just what I know of this winter due to being out in the streets. I'm just wondering when we're actually going to stop beating around the bush and actually do something about it. That's all I got to say.
Thank you.
Item 63, request of Tiffany Thompson to address council regarding support for Oregon Tradeswomen, Inc., trades and apprenticeship career class.
Good morning. Come on up.
Good morning to you all. Thank you so much for having me today. I actually wanted to come here to talk to you about Oregon Tradeswomen Incorporated's pre-apprenticeship training class for women in the trades. We offer a scholarship-based program that gets women ready to work in the construction trades, and we continue to support them after they enter into apprenticeship and then after they're on the job. And the reason I came here today is because City Council actually helped fund 30% of our last class, and we wanted to thank you for that. It was a very successful class, the largest graduation that we have had as of yet. 24 women graduated, and we had well over 100 people attend our graduation, which was fantastic. And I also wanted to share with you one particular success story of a woman named Brenda. So quickly, I'll just show you some pictures of our women. This is the women on one of our job sites. When they come into our class, their first day of the week, Tuesday, they are actually in a classroom setting, making sure that they have the mathematical skills to get through their courses, to make sure that they can work in the construction trades, which do require a fair amount of math. The second day, they work on job sites like this, where we do work for local nonprofits, various, mostly carpentry-based jobs. We've deconstructed a church before, and then like this, we're usually working on building sheds and things that other nonprofits need. And we have instructors that volunteer with us to teach the students. We also go out on field trips. So this is our group of women out with the heavy equipment operators. They get a chance to learn to drive the equipment, see if that's something that they would like to do, and they learn about those apprenticeship programs. We also have rigorous physical training for the women because the construction trades do require you to be so physically fit. We specifically have classes that teach them how to use the specific muscles you'll need for the various trades. And this here on the right is Brenda, who I will tell you more about in a moment. And on the left is Mandy. She is our class instructor. And this is our graduating class of women. They were not all able to be there because of some illness, but most of the women in this class are actually now employed. So that's fantastic for us. So now I'll move on to Brenda's story. Brenda had worked some in the construction trades on her own, but unfortunately she ended up having a drug addiction issue. She was incarcerated for a period of time, and when she came out, despite her previous experience, it was nearly impossible for her to find a job. She spent over a year looking for a job and found nothing. She finally heard about our pre-apprenticeship class from a close friend. She decided to sign up for the class to make sure that she knew everything that she needed to know, and also to be able to demonstrate to employers that she had, in fact, cleaned up and was a participating member of society again. During the class, Brenda was able to go on a field trip to American Heating Incorporated. On that field trip, she wasn't aware, but she ended up talking to the manager of that company and on that specific job site that day. He was so impressed by her and the things that she was learning in the class that the day after graduation on December 20th, he called us and asked for her by name. So we were able to secure Brenda with a job. She wanted to be able to be here today, but clearly working is more important. So that is where she's at today, and she wanted me to come and thank all of City Council for supporting our program today. So thank you all very much.
Oh, great. Thanks for your report. That's great news.
Brenda, before you go, if there's women watching that would like to get involved in this program, how do they contact you?
They can just give us a call at 503-335-8200. And all the information's there. They can also go to Oregon Tradeswomen. It's just tradeswomen.net. And they sign up for an informational class, and that will teach them all about what's required for the class, and we'll talk to them about how to get into it. And once again, it's scholarship-based, so it's no cost to the women, but it is not free. We talk to them about the significant financial impact that it has to join that. So thank you so much.
Great work. Thank you very much. All right. Let's move on to consent calendar. We've had a request to pull one item, which is number 70. Any other items to be pulled from consent? If not, then a roll call on the remainder of the consent calendar, please.
Fritz?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay. Item 64, time certain.
Accept rapid response vehicle budget note report.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a pleasure to introduce the rapid response, the report to council on the Portland Fire and Rescue Bureau's rapid response vehicles. And before I sort of turn it over to the chief to present that report, let me just give a little bit of perspective. It's now been about 7 months that we've had 24/7 rapid response vehicles as part of the fire and rescue's fleet. And it's also been about 7 months that I've been honored to be in charge of Portland Fire and Rescue. And, you know, I enjoy being the fire commissioner because I really enjoy and appreciate the good hard work that the people in Portland Fire and Rescue do every day to save lives and to keep people safe. And but also one of my goals as the commissioner in charge is to work with the chief and the bureau to become more modern, efficient, and effective in how we deliver services. And when one recognizes that some 70% of all calls for service that Portland Fire and Rescue receives are medical in nature, it doesn't take a great leap of faith to understand that there's a role for something like a rapid response vehicle, a small two-person vehicle that can respond to low-level medical calls without, so to speak, calling out the cavalry every time. And that's one of the most visceral reactions I get from people is, you know, why is there a fire engine and a fire truck and an AMR ambulance all responding to somebody with a sprained ankle? Well, part of the philosophy of rapid response vehicles is to get away from that so that we can have the appropriate number of personnel responding to the appropriate level of low-level medical incidents. And it doesn't take just, it's not just the Fire Bureau that is a player in this. It's also the Bureau of Emergency Communications and the Multnomah County Emergency Medical Office. And the budget note directed us to report back to Council in January on the success so far of the period of implementation, which, as I said, has been about 7 months now of full implementation. And I think, as the Chief will tell us, and Battalion Chief Ken Burns can also tell us, I think it's working well, and they'll go into more details on the data. But as I said, it is not working without having appropriate dispatch responses at BOEC and the support and the work of the Multnomah County Emergency Medical Office. And those remain works in progress. While work is going well, they remain works in progress, and I commit to you that and to the Council that, and all Portlanders, that we will continue to refine and improve the system so we get the most out of every firefighter and our equipment. And by using these smaller, nimble vehicles, I think you'll see in the report also, we are saving wear and tear on our larger fire engines and trucks, and probably saving wear and tear on our firefighters as well, and saving some money in the process as well. So with that, I'm just going to turn it over to Chief Jansons and Battalion Chief Ken Burns to give us the details.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. For the record, Aaron Jansons, Fire Chief, and I have with me Battalion Chief Ken Burns, who oversees our EMS and section and specifically is involved with the delivery of this pilot program and has does an enormous job of staying on top of the data and the statistics and doing an analysis and making sure that we are utilizing the program and finding any efficiencies that we can. So I thank you for all of your interest in it, and specifically Commissioner Salzman for his advocacy of the program. That was really the impetus of this program beginning not just 7 months ago where we put the four RRVs into service, but really the program beginning back in 2012 where we started an analysis and we actually utilized some peak staffing RRVs. And so thank you for that. Appreciate it. We've got a short presentation. We'll probably take 10 to 12 minutes, and then hopefully we'll be able to answer any questions that you might have. So the RRV program has consistently been an effort to improve response reliability and response times of our critical four-person fire and emergency response apparatus, also to reduce mileage, therefore wear and tear on more expensive apparatuses, Commissioner Salzman stated, and also save fuel maintenance and replacement costs of these apparatus. While the RRVs aren't capable of performing critical and fire rescue interventions, they do help, and they do not help maintain Portland's ISO or other fire protection ratings. When added, they're a very effective way to improve our response reliability of critical fire apparatus and crews. Therefore, we believe they're a beneficial addition to the system. The RRV program, with its focus on lower acuity healthcare calls, is a modification of the design recommendation by TRIAG Data in 2011. And the program has had some success improving our response reliability of the four-person crews, which we'll get into very shortly. It also provides some cost savings, although it's minimal because of the lower acuity calls. While medical calls are 70% of our overall call volume, the low acuity calls are actually about 7% of our overall call volume. So it's a higher percentage of the medical calls, but a smaller percentage of overall call volume. That makes any sense, and I'll get into more specifics. So Portland Fire and Rescue has been very focused on trying to make this program a success, and like all of our operations, we're consistently monitoring. Through the pilot program, we learned initial assignments of calls require extensive research and analysis. We've done this and reassigned 4 of the 15 three-type calls. And I'll try and stay away from jargon where I can, but a three-type call actually is a call where you respond with lights and sirens and in an urgent manner. And the RRVs are actually assisting with some of these calls that we've deemed safe for patient care where they are in their first-in fire management area. The other type, the 9-type calls, the 5,000 or 7% of our other calls that the RRVs are designed to go on, they can take up to 20 minutes. Initially, we assigned them a 15-minute response time, and we've since expanded that recently to include up to a 20-minute response time. We also have relocated one of the RRVs, or will be relocating one of the RRVs that was assigned downtown, and we're going to move that or relocate that over into North Portland, where we believe that that'll have more beneficial response. Other improvements we've made with the Type 9 responses at just over 5,000 over the last 12 months, with the 15-minute response window, the RRVs were only responding on about 60% of the Type 9 calls. So we believe that expanding this window up to a 20-minute response window is going to improve that 60%, possibly capture up to 85% of the Type 9 responses. So we believe that that'll be a benefit to the community and to the network citywide. We've also implemented some new triage protocols. With the new 20-minute response window, we think it's okay to take a little bit longer on these lower acuity calls to get to calls. And this improves the response reliability of critical fire and rescue apparatus because, as you know, if an RRV two-person unit isn't taking the call, then that means a four-person critical fire and rescue apparatus needs to be deployed. And if they're deployed, now they're out of service and not able to respond on another critical emergency call. So utilizing the RRVs for these low acuity calls is effective. So we've worked with BOEC to expand the 15-minute response window. And then in November 2013, all 4 of the RRVs bumped up from a 15 to 20-minute response window. We also revised the emergency call types. Some of the Type 3 emergency call types approved for the RRV response frequently required additional resources and capabilities than the RRVs can provide. So after analyzing patient outcomes, Portland Fire and Rescue worked with Multnomah County Emergency Medical Services Director and BOEC to reassign RRV responses to 4 Type 3 emergency call types that have consistently required either additional resources from 4-person crews or through studies indicated that there was a patient care issue that or potential patient care issue that we want to ensure that the right resources are there when needed. The reduction in the RRV Type 3 dispatches is a small percentage of the overall RRV responses and will create efficiency by improving patient care outcomes by having adequate resources there in a timely manner and utilizing fewer resources by dispatching 1 unit instead of needing to call for an additional unit on scene. Other revisions include the relocation of RRV1 to North Portland, which I've already talked about, and also working with BOAC to refine 911 dispatch cards to better determine whether patient lifting may require more than a 2-person crew, which does happen. So overall, this program has been anything but static, and we're constantly monitoring and evaluating it. I know that you all have the final report in front of you, and if you would like to look at the response reliability impact has been significant. At Station 11 and 19, since the implementation of the RRV program, they have averaged approximately an 8% improvement in the response reliability for the critical fire and rescue emergency apparatus, and that's significant. We also have tables that include cost per mile estimates and then program savings for the RRVs. And while the savings aren't significant, the improvements in the response reliability and the response times of the critical apparatus through the addition of an RRV program is significant, and especially in East Portland, where that has been suffering. We have seen a dramatic improvement in those response times or improvement. When I say improvement, that means response times have improved, therefore decreased, and response reliability has increased. So that's a dramatic improvement in East Portland. Also,
Station 11 is East Portland.
Yes, yes. Station 11 is at 92nd and Foster, roughly. Also, the RRVs are assisting us with working with Local 43 to pilot a program to help reduce healthcare costs, therefore leave more money for taxpayers to invest where they choose. So we believe that we're working and advocating strongly to be a part of the healthcare solution as healthcare is dramatically under reform. So with that, I'd like to open it up for any questions.
Where does the ambulance response come into this?
So on any type 9 call, there is no ambulance. That is a fire-only response where we can deploy a two-person crew to go and assess the patient and determine if there's additional resources needed. It may be something that we just need to go check on.
Why? So that's just because of the protocol?
Because they're not going to be transported, right? It's a kind of call.
Well, on the 9 type calls, which is about 5,000 a year, there isn't an ambulance response. And these are people maybe who are sick or have a very, were struck by an object, but they're telling the dispatcher through the triage that they're not in immediate need of medical or requesting an ambulance. Say that same person falls less than 10 feet, that's a different scenario. If they fall 30 feet, that's a different scenario. So the type codes, the one level, the three level, and the 9 level is the severity. On some of the dispatches that the RRVs go on, the ambulance respond, but not all of them. I would say roughly half those calls.
So I think we need a policy discussion, which we've started many times over the last 5 years, as to whether Portland Fire and Rescue should be responding to those low-level acuity calls.
At all.
At all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think just, if I could, just one example would be, say, like a UN1, someone's unconscious, not breathing. A UN3, someone was unconscious, and not breathing, but now they're still unconscious, they're still breathing.
That's not an ambulance call?
No, it still is. No, my point is to the 9 type codes. So someone has a syncopal episode. That would become a 9 type code. Someone had a temporary loss of consciousness, so Portland Fire would send a unit to check them. And I think that's the importance of continuing to some of the 9 type codes, because we don't really know why they had this period of unconsciousness.
Well, I would like us to have a council level discussion on that policy, and with healthcare reform, with health visitors, is it really the responsibility of uniformed firefighters, highly trained to do complicated things, to go check on somebody who fainted and is now doing all right?
Actually, Commissioner, we've had some initial conversations with folks in the healthcare industry about whether if we could adjust BOEX protocols and work with them to ensure that people are given other options.
Right.
And actually, the director, or maybe it's not the director, of EMS in Clark County is arranging a kind of a summit on the interaction between the EMS system and the overall healthcare system, and to bring in people from other states to talk about options that seem to be working. So I think that's I agree. That's definitely a conversation we continue to have.
And I think everybody's well aware that healthcare is under enormous reforms right now. And one of the things that we're looking at, and we're trying to promote more, is alternate destination or alternate transportation. That's the pilot we're involved in right now. With that, patients can save, and the healthcare system itself can save the enormous cost of expensive transportation and going to the most expensive place of treatment, which is the emergency department, and actually being transported via a cab or another source other than a very expensive ambulance ride, be transported to their healthcare provider or an urgent care, which is much lower cost. So we're actively engaged in that pilot program right now and looking to expand that to help ensure that there are more dollars saved, not only for the system, but for all the patients directly. And that ultimately should benefit everyone. It should benefit the entire system. Whether you call 911 or not, that should benefit everybody by lowering the overall healthcare costs.
And that pilot is looking at who is going to do those transports to the primary care provider, or is it just Portland Fire and Rescue?
Right now, we're calling cabs. We're calling private cabs, so as opposed to having you know, a range of anywhere from $300 to a $1,200 ambulance ride, we can get you in a cab there for $50.
Yes, that's good. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
Chief, do you know what percentage of the ROV calls wound up resulting in an ambulance transport?
Well, roughly, they're going on about 150 calls. This is the average of the four. They have a different response number depending on what district or station they're assigned to. But they respond on average of about 150 calls a month. 50 of those are just a public assist. Of those, the remaining 100, the ambulance transport rate is roughly, last time I checked, about 78%. So those calls, 78, yeah. The number of calls, the three type codes, generally speaking, result in transports. And that's really where the pilot is focused, as the three type codes that the RRVs go on is the potential to do some alternative care and transport.
So as of now, even in those calls that have identified as low acuity, therefore the RRVs are going out 78% of the time, they result in an ambulance transport.
No. I don't think that that's the...
No. I think, you know, there's a difference between the nine type codes and the three type codes. And that was my illustration that I tried to give with the unconscious person. There's the lowest is the nine type codes, and those are truly good.
Okay, but what was the 78%? I thought you just said that 78% of the type three calls where the RVs went out resulted in ambulance transports.
Of those three type codes?
Of those type three
calls. So if I can clarify and... interpret here.
Okay.
He's asking, of the nine calls that we go on, how many of those result in transport?
Well, of the nine calls, none.
Of the three calls that RRVs responded to, how many of those wound up having an ambulance transport?
Yeah. And that's the stand. That's a high number of transports.
Together.
Yeah, and that's the difference between the lowest, meaning the nine type codes, which we feel comfortable sending fire only to check and advise.
Yeah.
And then you have your three type codes that are not unconscious, unresponsive. They still have a medical need, but that need can be met by two firefighters responding and doing an assessment. Now, often, although we are working with BOEC, sometimes they do need to call for additional resources. So the three type codes we still consider as an acute call with the medical need. It just is a subgroup of the type codes that don't need four people responding from the fire bureau.
Mm-hmm. And another percentage question. Chief, I think you said that the number of calls that will be sort of moved out of the RRV group, I mean, because of these four subcodes that you're mm-hmm. removing, was a small percentage of the overall RRV calls. How small a percentage?
I hope he has it, because I don't have that percentage.
I should have let me tell you what the remainder is. The 11 type codes, the 11 three type codes that ambulance and fire both respond to account for roughly 10,000 calls a year, 10,500. Remember, one of the factors of reducing the group of those three type codes, say, for example, we had an OB, we had a pregnant someone who's pregnant calls 911. If they have already had the baby or is about to have the baby, that would be a one-level type code. We would send both types of units. If they're a pregnant and they ever have an issues with their pregnancy, that becomes a three. If the issue is related to their pregnancy, we want to send ambulance and fire. And perhaps some of those cases actually result in a delivery, even though it was coded a three type code. Someone who's pregnant who has a headache gets a nine level type code. So to get back to your question, the number of calls that we removed, I couldn't give you a concrete answer of the percentage. I know that I just yesterday ran the balance of what our expected call volume will be of what remains. And I guess my thought process there is, we weren't getting to the nine type codes, the truly fire-only check and advise. So we made a decision to take some of the calls that required additional resources and not send our two-person unit to those calls and make them more readily available for the other calls that we knew that they could have the appropriate resources for, but they were on these calls when they should have been on these calls. So we kind of had our triage system struggling to get the right resource to the right call.
Can I jump in for a second? I'm beginning to get lost in the data, and I want to get back to the just sure. what you're reporting to us. So currently, according to your report, about 7% of emergency calls can be covered by RRVs. Is that correct?
Correct.
And are you proposing that we expand that, or do you think that, or do you believe that's the right ratio?
We think we're about at the right ratio right now, simply because with a 20-minute response time, those RRVs can respond not only in the primary station, the station's fire management area that they're assigned, but they can respond out to all of the surrounding fire management areas that they are adjoined. With a 20-minute response time, they may be able to go one fire management area further. So we think we have pretty good saturation. I mentioned that it's anything but static. We're continuing to monitor the program. We're not only looking at relocating the RRV that was assigned downtown, where they already have a pretty good response reliability, move that to North Portland, where they could benefit more from an RRV who wasn't able to make it into North Portland from downtown within that 15-minute response,
yeah.
relocate it, have better saturation for the response. But we're also looking at one of the stations out in East County or East Portland. The struggle is some logistical issues, but I expect that to probably be resolved by the summer.
Okay, so we're looking at about 7. You're addressing 7%. About 7% of emergency calls, and you're at this stage, this point, you're not asking us to expand the capacity. Would you remind us how much of the RRV costs are covered by one-time funding, and how much are covered by ongoing funding?
Currently they're covered by the SAFER grant.
The SAFER grant,
right?
So. And that's a two-year grant?
Correct.
And so if we wanted to continue this in 2 years, we're going to have to find a way to backfill it.
Correct.
Number three, I'm trying to, in the last two pages of your report, just figure out what the cost savings are and how you calculate it.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just give us that number and how you got there?
Sure. Actually, if I could bring Jay up, he could explain it to you because he developed all the cost savings. You mind if I bring Jay Guo up or
okay.
business operations?
But I'll take it at a very gross level. I mean, what's the cost savings and just how did you get there?
Hi, I'm Jay Guo, senior management, business operation manager with the Fire Bureau. What we look at that is based on cost per mile, and we compare cost per mile with RRV and cost per mile with engine or truck. So that's the difference. And the difference is cost per mile.
If I can, I'm going to jump in real quick. I think what
the
Commissioner Salzman's, yeah,
and then
what you're looking for is based on we amortize the cost of the apparatus over the life of the apparatus, frontline useful life, all of the maintenance costs, the fuel costs. We look at the mileage, and so he calculated a per mile cost that each apparatus we expect each apparatus to cost over its life.
And that's not net of the expense of the RRVs. You're just talking about the savings of the other vehicle.
I think it is net.
We did both.
Did net.
So we looked at the cost of an apparatus per mileage cost, and then we looked at the cost of an RRV per mileage cost.
And so on an annualized basis, what's the cost savings? Just what's that number?
This is for the 4 months is...
No, sir, just on an
annualized
basis.
What's
the number? Grossed it up for the
year. It's about 6,000 a year.
I'm sorry?
About 6,000 a year.
Total differential 6, between...
Yeah, 5,600.
That's 5,600 for four RRVs.
Right.
So that's a cost savings that the four RRVs combined provide.
Is
less than 6,000.
Yeah.
A year.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's not significant, but the improvement in the response reliability of the critical fire and rescue apparatus is.
So that's where I was going with my, should we get out of this business at all? That doesn't seem to be saving us a lot of apparatus money. It's dedicating firefighters. One thing I found particularly interesting in your report was that 93% of the calls require four responders, which I've been mm-hmm. hearing from the Firefighters Association for many years, and
mm-hmm.
I agree.
Mm-hmm.
The complicated medical calls need four people.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the ones, and plus those are the ones that we need to get there before 15 minutes, never mind before 20
Correct.
Minutes.
Time is critical.
So I think we should be looking at getting out of the low-level response business.
Can you yield on one point? The other piece that we talked about, I think, in a work session once was the inequity in terms of the reimbursement. The ambulance, you know, so I used the example once, Chief, of when my daughter had a fainting spell.
Right.
We called, and we had a fire truck come, and we had an ambulance come.
Mm-hmm.
So the fire truck came. We're paying for that, that four-person crew, and my daughter was thrilled to be carried down the stairs by four strong firefighters and out to the ambulance. Mm-hmm. The ambulance billed us $1,000 to take her six blocks to the hospital. So the ambulance gets reimbursed. They bill and they get paid for their service. We cover the four firefighters who were there. And it's this inequity of one parallel systems.
Right.
And probably on that call we didn't need a full rig and four firefighters, but that's the way the system works. They were the first responders.
Mm-hmm.
So if it had been a more serious problem, we had a firefighter and an EMT. But the inequity of one system being reimbursed through a rather extravagant bill, which reflects cost shifting, because the unreimbursed care is factored in. That's why it cost me $1,000 to send someone an ambulance six mm-hmm. blocks. But the firefighters are paid for separately. We don't get a reimbursement. And to me, that is also
mm-hmm.
a challenge here.
And that is one of the great efficiencies that fire and rescue departments have been providing for over 30 years of responding on medical calls. But yes, it's a equity issue of has not been any reimbursement from healthcare to kind of subsidize that system. So we're also pursuing that pretty aggressively, and it'll be interesting how things unfold.
This is something actually that we should be talking to our congressional delegation about, because in the conversations I've had with the medical industry about this, they've said that Medicare tends to kind of set the standard. So if Medicare decided that they were going to change the way they reimburse and would reimburse for firefighter medical operations, then the rest of the industry would take their lead.
Well, and by the way, it extends to other areas. Dan mm-hmm. is in charge of housing and fire. So what we find in the wintertime, for example, if you're at one of the downtown shelters
mm-hmm.
and someone has a medical event, firefighter shows up, treats that person, transports them to the nearest hospital. They spend the night. At the end of the day, the bill for that service, for what we don't mm-hmm. charge, what the ambulance does pass on to the rest of us and the emergency care, would probably house that person for 6 months. But it's externalized, so we don't actually see that cost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the irrational part of the system. It's the highest cost delivery service producing the lowest possible public benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Further questions? Good discussion, good report.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have anyone signed up to testify on this?
No one signed up.
Okay. Thank you.
Move to accept the report, Mayor.
Second.
Further discussion? Roll call, please.
Fritz?
Well, thank you, Commissioner Salzman, for championing this program and for bringing the data to us so that we can have a robust discussion during the budget process about next steps. And thanks, Commissioner Fish, for clarifying with the chief that this is a two-year funded by the SAFER grant so that we don't have to make an immediate decision about it. But still, you know, 93% of the fire and rescue calls require four responders, 7% low acuity. We need to have a discussion about, is there a better way to provide services to citizens that doesn't involve such intense response? I'm very pleased to see the focus on firefighters being careful and calling for backup when there's a heavy lift. I think that the report shows that that's back injuries are some of the highest reasons for our firefighters being off work. And you know, that was certainly something that as a nurse over the 27 years that I practiced that we became more and more aware of, is that you don't get macho and lift folks who are too heavy. You call for backup or you get equipment. So there's a wealth of information in this report. It touches on the difference in equipment costs between the engines and the trucks, including the Quints, which I think is another fascinating piece that we're going to be looking at over the course of the budget. So great to have all this data. Thank you very much. Aye.
Fish?
Thank you, Dan, for your leadership. Thank you, Chief, for an excellent report. And what you've done is you've given us more information to upon which to make some informed decisions as we go forward and have this discussion. So thank you for your good work. Bye.
Saltzman?
Well, I want to thank the chief and all the members of Portland Fire and Rescue for being willing to innovate here and to innovate in a way that makes us more nimble on our feet. And while there may be some question about the types of calls and whether fire should be the appropriate responder, I think we have to look at the present situation right now and recognize that right now it's often a question of whether fire is the responder. I mean, there's no question that fire is going to respond to a situation. It's whether they're going to respond now with a two-person nimble or rapid response vehicle or a heavier fire engine or fire truck, which is a more costly option. And I think the other takeaway from this, our seven-month pilot so far, is that, as the chief indicated, is that response reliability for the heavier apparatus is improving by being able to have the two-person vehicles respond sort of to the peak load effect. So that's improving the response times for our heavier apparatus, and that's helping to make people safer. So good work. We're going to continue to try to figure out all these good questions my colleagues have asked, and I hope to do that, you know, with my colleagues, because there's a lot of vexing questions with healthcare reform and everything else going on here. But I think we're showing some good progress, and I think we're delivering some good results that our citizens and our taxpayers expect of us. Aye.
Novick.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chief. And I hope a lot of people happen to be watching this discussion, because I think some people might look at this and say, okay, you're only talking about 7% of the calls, so why even bother? But the fact is, we might be talking about 7% of the calls, but we're improving response reliability throughout the system. And 7% of a big system is still something worth worrying about. And if we can use public resources more efficiently and assure a truly appropriate response to each situation, that's worth doing, whether we're talking about 70% or 7%. So thank everybody very much for their work. Look forward to continuing this discussion. Please to vote aye.
Hales?
Well, I'm very happy to see this discussion. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman and Bureau, and BOAC as well. It's great that we can use Fire Bureau and innovation in the same sentence. And this is a really clear indication that innovation is happening, and I appreciate it very much. I think this council discussion was also excellent in that it illustrates that not only do we need to have good cooperative working relationships between bureaus and commissioners' offices in order to make use of this kind of innovation, but we're also going to have some serious work to do with Multnomah County and our congressional delegation with respect to the larger issues of who does transport, who gets reimbursed, what does the medical reimbursement system do differently under healthcare reform. These are big, important topics, and I think I'm bullish about those as well, because we do have good working relationships with Multnomah County and with our congressional delegation, and we can roll up our sleeves and work on those issues. So the value to date internally has been well documented in this report. But the potential value is going to expand considerably if we're able to use those good working relationships with other governments and change more of the architecture beyond the equipment and our own internal protocols. So that's, I think, some of the work ahead. I spent part of yesterday with Chair Madrigal working on issues where we have shared responsibilities and overlap. And I think, again, we have a kind of good dialogue between the city and Multnomah County where we can continue to work on these complex intergovernmental issues and make improvements. Aside from all the numbers and wonkish stuff of how we provide services, I think the perception is also important that for some low acuity calls now, we're sending what will appear to our citizens and also actually is the right number of firefighters. Two people for these low acuity calls is the right number, not four. And I think we build the public's support for what we do when we seem to do it in a smart and efficient way. And that's what the perception matters here as well as the reality. So I'm happy about both the facts and how that will be received in the community, and I appreciate the good work so far. Aye.